Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. In that war, there are people who are warriors. There are people who are observers. There are people who are sitting it out. And one of the people that I'm very pleased to say has been a warrior for a long time is former Congressman Fred Grandy. He is now a senior fellow for national security affairs at the Center for Security Policy and a man who has been contributing mightily, not least through his contributions to this program in the War of Ideas front of that larger war. And Fred, it's always good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's start with sort of developments in the Middle East. Most especially of concern, Fred, I know to both of us, is the seemingly ever more aggressive behavior of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. What's the latest on that, and where do you think this is headed?
Well, I think there are two developments worth talking about. One that's probably pretty well known, one that may not be as much so. The one that's well known is Morsi promising a greater crackdown against what he calls activists. These are apparently members of this coalition, the National Salvation Front, which is to a large degree made up of either secular Muslims, moderate Muslims, Christians, but people who are opposed to the ongoing gridlock that the Muslim Brotherhood has over the government. And they've been demonstrating because whatever democratic forms were promised have not only been denied, they've been cut back. So Morsi is now saying, you do this at your peril, and we will prosecute you, and it may get a lot worse before it gets better. So to some degree, he is now replicating the kind of crackdowns that his predecessor, Hosni Mubarak, did when he was cracking down on democratic rebellion. But this time we've got an Islamist in charge as opposed to supposedly a secular leader. The thing that's not as well known, and this is interesting as well, and certainly I think worth putting into this context, is according to Raymond Ibrahim, who's somebody we know pretty well, who's obviously tracks these kinds of discussions, Morsi, when he was in Pakistan, at least made some kind of agreement, or so we're led to believe, to allow covertly Ayman al-Zawahiri back into Egypt. Now, if that's true, that is even more troubling. And I have to say, not surprising.
Yeah. Well, it would be profoundly worrying on a number of different scores, not least of which we keep providing money and arms to a regime that would thereby be helping al-Qaeda at senior most levels. Fred, one other piece of the Middle East that I wanted to touch on. We haven't spoken since the return of President Obama from travels that involved, among other things, engineering an apology from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to his Turkish counterpart, Recep Erdogan. Give us your take on that apology. Was it advisable, and is it working out?
I don't know. I actually, whether it's working out or not, I don't know. I think that this was mostly symbol and very little substance. I wouldn't be surprised if Obama, who seems to keep in much closer contact with Erdogan than he does with Netanyahu, kind of did this at his request and perhaps asked Netanyahu to kind of gloss over or sanitize this rift. The real question is, are we going to see a thawing of the hostile relation between Israel and Turkey, who used to be pretty strong allies? And I think the answer to that is not yet. Not yes. I mean, one of the things we know about Obama, Frank, from whether or not he's speaking in Israel or a few years ago in Cairo, is he has a great opening act and usually no close. And so this may just be a kind of public relations gambit. To that end, I'm also wondering what he meant when he spoke to the Palestinian groups in Ramallah and said, essentially the settlements are unhelpful, but he did not say illegitimate. In other words, he kind of backed off from Joe Biden, who said was much more severe about the institution of the settlements. And Obama pretty much told the Palestinians, look, you're going to have to get used to this. Now, what I hope that
Well, what he specifically indicated was that you can't expect that they're going to stop it as a precondition for getting into talks. And that was a big walk back from where they were a little while ago, the Obama administration. Go ahead.
And I'm curious to know why he did that, except that he must be getting some heat from Jewish groups, and by that I mean core constituent Democratic coalitions that are advocating for Israeli causes, who said, look, we've gone too far in the opposite direction. And
that combined with the fact that it just was a non-starter, I guess, is perhaps a reason for revising his position. Fred, let's swing from the Middle East, where we see the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists, including in Turkey, seemingly very much ascendant, to Washington, a man who has been kind of, I think of him as the poster child of the Obama administration's embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, in his case, literally the embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, is a fellow by the name of Thomas Peres, who has been nominated now by the president to become the next Secretary of Labor. What do we know about Peres in his role in the Justice Department, and should we be concerned about this guy getting a promotion to cabinet level rank?
Well, I guess the good news is that he's leaving the Justice Department, where he has been, as you pointed out, a very good friend and huggable buddy to people like Mohammed Majid, the head of the Islamic Society of North America. He's also the guy who told Trent Franks in testimony before a judiciary subcommittee that he could really not confirm whether or not he would protect free speech at all costs, particularly as it related to religion. And he's also the guy at Justice who presided over that defense of that school teacher, remember, in Illinois, who wanted to go to Mecca to make Hajj, and the Justice Department defended her. So he is, I think, probably as good a local friend of the Muslim Brotherhood as there is in the administration. And what effect that will have on labor remains to be seen. But this guy is an old line progressive. I mean, he began as an aide to Ted Kennedy. He was on the Montgomery County Council here in Maryland, and then easily segued into very progressive roles at Justice, where
Division. Knowing of your connection now to Maryland, I know you're very aware of one other role that he played, which you haven't mentioned, which was very much of importance to his job at Labor, should he get this post. He was the president of Casa de Maryland, which is not just progressive. This is a radical institution that has engaged in promoting illegal aliens and helping them violate our laws for years. It's just kind of an amazing indictment of the administration that it would think about putting somebody with that kind of background and record in such a position. Let me turn quickly to one other issue that is evidence, I think, of the work of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States that's worth discussing with you, Fred Grandy, now with the Center for Security Policy and former member of Congress. You have talked about, sort of the political warfare that these various Muslim Brotherhood front organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations, you mentioned Mohammed Majid of the Islamic Society of North America, and others have engaged in. There's a kind of ad war going on at the moment between a colleague of ours, Pamela Geller, the efforts that she's been making to stop the Islamization of America, on the one hand, and these Brotherhood fronts featuring, sort of competing ads. The brothers have been talking about my jihad and, stop the apartheid in Israel, and Pam Geller's been going right back at them. What's going on here, and how important is it to our understanding of the true nature of the Islamist agenda?
Well, the true nature of the Islamist agenda, obviously, and this is coming from the Quran, not from yours or my political views, is that jihad is aggression against non-Muslims, and it is mandated. It's not just suggested.
Holy war.
But that is something that no less a person than now the director of the CIA, John Brennan, pretty much tried to obfuscate when he said, well, jihad is a personal struggle. And this is what the My Jihad campaign is about. They're trying to take, and to her credit, Pamela Geller's ads that were talking about side with the civilized person and not the savage when she was fighting in the New York subway system to get these pro-Israel adds up, has apparently influenced them enough so they need some kind of a counter-movement. Unfortunately, if my jihad becomes a kind of spiritual fitness program, then I think the ability of the Muslim Brotherhood to kind of infiltrate and inculcate their message through what would normally be kind of harmless little slogans is even more dangerous.
Yeah, quite insidious. Fred, we have to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us, as always. It's good to talk with you, and welcome back from vacation. We'll look forward to visiting with you next week, as always. Next up, we will be speaking with Joe Connor and Michael Duncan about what the framers would make of all of this and more straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have a very, very interesting segment to talk with you about now, featuring two guests, the co-authors of a marvelous new book, The New Founders. Joseph Connor and Michael Duncan have joined forces to give us a perspective on the marvels of this country, as seen both through the eyes of the framers in their writings at the time and how they might see it today. And gentlemen, it's great to have you with us. Joe Connor, of course, is a man that many of us have known and revered for a long time. His father, Frank, was one of the victims in the terrorist attack mounted by the FALN on Francis Tavern in New York. And he has been active through 9/11 on these issues. And his colleague, Mike Duncan, from classmate, I guess, and friend from Villanova in the old days, now with the financial services industry. Congratulations on your new book. Thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about it here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having
us. Thank you, Frank.
Joe, let's talk a little bit about the concept behind the book, what you're trying to do with it, and the sort of technique that you employed.
Actually, I had the idea for the book as I was driving back from a meeting that you were at with some United Liberty Alliance people a couple of years ago, and looking at the driving back from D.C. to New Jersey, looking at the beautiful country that we live in. I had a conversation with George Washington sitting next to me in the passenger seat of the car, as I thought, like, what would he think about the world today? And I kind of put it on the back burner until about six months later, I had the idea again, and I called Mike. Mike was writing a screenplay, and I said, well, what if we put the founders in today's world using their own words, because they wrote everything. We know what they thought. They knew what they were doing was special, so they documented everything. And Mike was writing a screenplay. I thought maybe this would be a good movie. We came together. It ended up being a book, and it's done quite well.
Well, congratulations on it, and I think its insights are tremendously important. And I'd like to go through with you guys some of those that are particularly relevant to kind of the work that we're about in terms of educating the public about the challenges to this great country. And you're absolutely right, that's what it is, involving our national security and homeland security. And one of those is the priority that the framers gave to providing for the common defense and assuring the security of this country. Do you think that they would recognize the U.S. government today as an entity that seems to be doing an awful lot of that, the other stuff, and very little of that?
This is Mike. That's a great question, Frank. It's interesting. The founders, people easily forget that, the founders were mostly military guys, military veterans. And so the defense of our country, was at the forefront of all their issues. And, as Joe will probably point out in a second, I mean, it was tied economically back then, and as it is tied economically now. But they viewed that as, first and foremost amongst, maintaining liberties, not just in the late 1700s, but, ongoing as well.
Yeah, they knew that a strong military was the key to liberty, and Washington said time and time again that in order to avoid war, you keep a strong defense, you keep borders strong. James Madison talked a lot about that too, about you can bring in immigrants, but you got to keep your borders controlled, and you got to bring in the right people. And they wouldn't recognize the country now in that it has let itself open to so many attacks from within.
Yeah, well, and so many immigrants who may not be the right sorts, self-selected immigrants,
exactly.
And taking advantage of what remains very much an open border. And I got to believe that they would find that unbelievable, that we would be tolerating this in to some extent with the failure of the Obama administration to enforce the law, actually encouraging it.
Yeah, that we have encouraged it. We have a great asset. It's called U.S. citizenship, yet we throw it away. And from an economic standpoint, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. One of the other things that was very much an insight into the framers' thinking that you've addressed in the book, The New Founders, and again, our guests are Joe Connor and Mike Duncan, the co-authors of this wonderful new book with a very effusive foreword by Dick Morris, is the admonition from George Washington that we should avoid entangling alliances. And we have a lot of different alliances, of course, these days. They may have a somewhat different view of some of them than others. But the ones that I'd be particularly interested in, sort of your channeling them on, would be the role that the United States is now in with international organizations, one of which is trying to impose, for example, at the moment, an international arms trade treaty with, I think, implications for our Second Amendment rights. But what do you think they'd have made of that, particularly George Washington?
Yeah, this is Mike. Washington, when he comes back, the way we have it in the book, he sees the greatness of the country, but he also sees how we've gone off track. It's hard to imagine what he would think, because, from a Homeland Security standpoint, I think the Homeland Security Department today might view George Washington and the founders, quite frankly, as terrorists. They look down on people who exhibit individual liberty. Somebody who says I'm for nationalism, I'm anti-global, and all that. They get immediately put on the terrorist list, and probably at a higher level than maybe the Saudis, who don't have to present too many things coming into this country anymore. Washington back then, he understood, how intricate and how sensitive these foreign relationships were. He was very wary of them back then. I mean, granted, we were fighting British in the Revolution, and it took a number of years for the French to come to our assistance, and, of course, it ultimately helped us, win the battle.
Yes, win the war, at least.
win the war, of course, but he was still wary of the French as well, and that played into it. You know, he was wary of Spain.
But my question really deals with sort of the threat to sovereignty that a lot of these international organizations and the treaties that they promulgate represent. I've got to believe that would be kind of the thing he would have had in mind, urging us to be very wary of.
Absolutely, and it's a nationalistic viewpoint that has been kind of splintered in this country today.
Right. Let me ask you quickly, if I can, about another topic that's very much relevant, Joe, to particularly the work that you've been doing in, you know, opposing Eric Holder's nomination and countering, you know, sort of the Islamization that has been tolerated by successive administrations, I'm sorry to say, and their advance of terror. This question of the Islamist efforts at the moment seemingly being embraced to some extent by Eric Holder and, as we were talking earlier in the program with Fred Grandy, by Tom Perez, his assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and the president himself, for that matter, that would infringe upon our freedom of speech, one of the foundational freedoms in the First Amendment.
Yeah.
What do you think the framers would have made of that, and how hard would they be pressing back against it at this point?
Well, they would be appalled by what's going on. When you are labeled a xenophobe or anti-Islamic or whatever the terms that they're using now, or red baiter in the old days, that's designed to shut you up. And someone like James Madison would be absolutely appalled by that. They would be pushing back, and they would say that you know, that's tyranny, and it's up to the American people to understand that, and it's up to us to get the word out. And quite frankly, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle because of a media that promulgates this kind of garbage, and puts down people who try to be nothing more than keep the principles that made this country great.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the idea of this book was, after I testified against Holder and Hillary Clinton, and he became Attorney General, she became Secretary of State, I realized we're doing something wrong, right? I mean, these guys were doing great, and I was losing. So the book came out to try to educate people as to the magnificence of our country. And, you know, Sun Tzu said, as long as you have to know your own country, know your strengths, know who you are, before you can really go ahead and defeat the enemy. And that part of the idea of this book was to let people know that their views on liberty, their views on just life in general, are not very different from what the founders thought. The founders understood people, and they didn't believe government was the way. They believed they had confidence in the American people. It's a very simple concept, and somehow we've complicated it and destroyed it in a lot of ways. And the founders they wouldn't recognize, as Mike has pointed out several times, what they fought a revolution against, which was some taxes, was nothing compared to the tyranny that we're facing now in the American people.
It is indeed. Gentlemen, we have to let you go with that. We're speaking again and have had the privilege of being addressed by Joe Connor and Mike Duncan, the authors of The New Founders.
Can we give our website, Frank?
Yes, indeed, please.
It's www.thenewfounders.net, thenewfounders.net. Please
check it out.
Yeah,
great resource, as is the book. Gentlemen, we hope you'll come back and keep us up to date as to the founders' thinking on these issues of our time. It's critically important and a real public service that you've done. Next up, we'll be talking with Roger Noriega about some challenges south of that border. It's too open. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. North Korea says it is heightening the alert status of missiles aimed at allied assets in Asia. The pretext for this latest threat is a U.S. show of force yesterday as two B-2 stealth aircraft dropped dummy bombs in South Korea. The public in this country is being assured that the North Koreans do not have the means to attack us here at home. Unfortunately, this is wrong and misleading. Pyongyang may lack the capability to do so from its own territory, but it has large numbers of shorter-range missiles that could be brought by ship close to our shores. The United States needs effective means of monitoring, detecting, and countering such threats, and protecting particularly our electrical grid against the electromagnetic pulse attack they could inflict here. And we need them now. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we are with great regularity, I'm happy to say, by our friend and colleague Roger Noriega, former U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States and Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, man we turn to for insights into what is happening south of our border, in particular. What is the latest in Venezuela? Roger, welcome back. It's good to hear from you. Tell me what the presidential campaign, truncated, short order as it may be, is evolving into, as you see it.
Well, the election to choose Chavez's successor, who will finish that term, will be held on April 14th. He has anointed Nicolas Maduro to be the candidate of his movement, and Maduro's been sort of an erratic candidate, really a poor candidate, a very pale imitation of the bombastic Chavez, and he's becoming sort of a laughingstock, quite frankly, in his own country. At the same time, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, the Democratic governor of Miranda State, who's running again to face Maduro this time, is much more aggressive, taking on Maduro and ridiculing him in a fashion, frankly, that Venezuelan voters sort of appreciate. And at the same time saying, you know, this guy's has no legitimate claim to the presidency. They wrecked the country, and saying that of Maduro, and giving him a run for his money. Now, of course, the process is totally rigged, and it would require a rather dramatic breakdown in the Chavista movement's ability to mobilize their voters for Capriles to win. But they might have to resort to a much more transparent fraud that they've used in the past, that may generate a little more domestic rejection in Venezuela and maybe international condemnation. But that's asking an awful lot. But as I've said, in the short run, it's not a stable succession within Chavismo, and in the long run, it's not sustainable because they've just wrecked that economy, and there's no way out for them. And so even if Maduro is reelected, I expect that it will be a very difficult tenure for him.
Yeah, it's already beginning to have some ripple effects throughout the region, the absence of Chavez. And one of the places where this is perhaps being manifested rather starkly, Roger Noriega, is with respect to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Human rights not being very much in evidence in a lot of the places where Chavismo has taken hold. What's going on with this commission, and what might it be telling us about the future course of Latin America?
Well, part of Chavez's regional agenda has been to sort of batter these institutions that used to stand for defense of human rights and democracy, and made the OAS, the Organization of American States, for example, a unique institution, because there was actually, it was not a values neutral institution. It was favored representative democracy. And he set out to batter those institutions and did so rather successfully. But that wouldn't have been possible if the Latin countries hadn't knuckled under to him. But so now Chavez, the bully, is off the stage. And so while Chavez was dying, they had proffered some amendments that would have neutered the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And in the meantime, Chavez dies, and these reforms come up for a vote, and the Latins, guess what, climb out from under their desks and say, no, we're not going to do this. So it was a humiliating defeat for what's left of Chavismo, and I think it may be the end of the line for that regional consensus if the Latins can muster enough courage to stand by their own principles and defend democracy and human rights again. And it's going to require the U.S. to be a lot more bold, quite frankly. I was ambassador to that organization, and if the U.S. takes the initiative, if we find like-minded countries to take the initiative, we can push it in the right direction, so that you just can't slip into the background, expect good things to happen in that or any other international organization.
It does take leadership, indeed, and I'm afraid it's missing at the moment in our representation at the Organization of American States. We're speaking with the former U.S. ambassador to that organization, Roger Noriega, now a visiting fellow with the American Enterprise Institute and the driving force behind a terrific web resource, interamericansecuritywatch.com. And Roger, one of the items that you have posted there is from the Atlantic magazine, talking about another interesting telltale of where the region is headed. You have the president of Argentina apparently somewhat adrift without her lodestar, Hugo Chavez. Tell us where you think the Kirchner regime is likely to go and take that very important country in the region.
Well, the American Enterprise Institute published a paper that my colleague Jose Cardenas and I did recently on Argentina's race to the bottom. The Kirchner governments there, successive governments, Cristina now and her late husband before, Nestor, have really battered the institutions of democracy and the rule of law pretty relentlessly in Argentina in order to hold on to power. And they've also, as in the process, frightened away investors somewhat the way Chavez did in Venezuela. So, it's the international pariah when it comes to defaults and all of that, and is in the dock in the United States for its failure to pay for bonds. So Chavez swept in and bought billions of dollars worth of bonds, and essentially were money laundering exercises, and kept Argentina afloat. That's not going to happen again. And so I think that they're sort of in a cul-de-sac themselves in Argentina. Kirchner's all out of ideas. She's even breaking out these old chestnuts about the Falkland Islands and all that. But she's met her match, frankly, in the current British government and in the hale and hearty people of the Falklands. So it's, you know, with the economy having serious problems there, inflation out of control, insecurity on the streets of Buenos Aires, it's really going to test someone who's really proven to be a very weak leader.
Well, let's hope that one comes a cropper relatively soon. Another regime that we've been watching closely, as needless to say you have, Roger Noriega, is that of Cuba. And I wondered what your take is on the current lineup of what seems to be a military junta that is being brought to the fore, I guess, as the end of the Castro dynasty is beginning to loom.
Well, it's interesting that these Castro apologists who've been around for a long, long time are always looking for the pony in the pile of manure. And recently, Raul said that he was going to hand off power. Here's an 82-year-old man actually talking about handing power off in 5 years to some toady of the regime. And it's all about holding on to power for as long as they can. They're really in an existential fight in terms of hand-picking a successor in Venezuela who will keep $4 to $5 billion worth of cheap oil coming into Cuba. So there were recent numbers out in terms of imports and exports from Cuba. Absolute collapse in the last 12 months. I mean, you would think that the Obama policies were at work there. And it's just not a sustainable situation.
Obama policies, you mean our domestic economic policies, not our policies for bringing down the Castro regime.
No, our policies for the good point.
Just clarification there.
They do very little to confront that regime. Mm-hmm. But we ought to be prepared. I pray that we're prepared for transition in Cuba, because that sort of thing could happen precipitously as that very brittle regime breaks down and these octogenarians that are running the place sort of run out of tricks.
Right. We're just right a minute left. Roger Noriega, very quickly, does this 14-man junta suggest that there is a transition that could take over for the Castros?
It's not sustainable, Frank. I think they're whistling past the graveyard here with these solutions. I think that you know there was a very dynamic young woman as a blogger, Joni Sanchez, who just made an 80-day swing through countries. Very brilliant lady, and quite frankly, she may not be the leader of tomorrow, but if that's the sort of courageous, talented people that that are among the democratic opposition in Venezuela, in Cuba, the future will be bright, but with Democrats running the place, not tyrants.
But we better be positioned to give them a hand, that's for sure. Roger Noriega, we have to let you go. Thank you very much, as always, for your extraordinarily important insights into part of the world that is vital to this country's interests. Next up, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz about China, the latest incursions into our economy and security. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight. 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, the man we turn to at this stage of our week, each week, to visit about what's going on, as he likes to say, inside the ring, and more generally with respect to our national security. Inside the Ring, of course, is the column that he has been masterfully writing for years now in the Washington Times. He's also the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon. Bill, great to have you with us as always. A lot of ground to cover.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Listen, we've been talking for some time now, Bill, about a problem with the Chinese government and various operations that are reasonably believed to be connected with them that have very severe national security implications. And I was struck by a piece in the, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal yesterday's front page about the problem that Sprint, an American company that does a lot of business with the U.S. government, is now having over some of its hardware being supplied, we believe, by Huawei and ZTE. Tell us about those companies and why we should be concerned that our government, or for that matter, any of us, are using their equipment.
Yeah, well, the business community in general and the pro-China camp, as I call them specifically, insist on treating China as a normal nation when, in fact, they remain, as the late Constantine Mengus said, a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship. And we've seen a massive theft of intellectual property and secrets that is not new. I mean, it's been going on for 10 years, and this has been done through cyber espionage, and this is the real problem. The electronic equipment that the Chinese are using is loaded with backdoors and trapdoors, things that can be used to break into computer systems and networks. And this is the future. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like a low-level warfare that's already been going on. The problem is only one side recognizes that they're engaged in warfare, and the U.S. side has been slow to react.
Yeah, if they've been reacting at all. And, Bill, you've been warning about this for many years, including in your terrific book, The China Threat. And I'm just struck by the fact that, as you say, so many seemingly are still inattentive to the problem, or worse yet, apologizing for it and thereby enabling it. We've had just in the space of the past day an interesting development in a case of a fellow who was trying to steal the old-fashioned way, steal, it appears, some of our technology from Langley NASA, a fellow by the name of Bo Zhang. He's apparently now been ordered released by a federal judge rather than awaiting trial, despite real concerns that he will flee the country. How does that fit into the larger picture, Bill, the kind of traditional espionage that China's been waging against us, as well as cyber espionage?
Right. And we also had the recent case out in the Pacific Command of a honey trap case where a contractor with access to nuclear weapon secrets was passing that data to a woman Chinese agent. The Chinese, it's a full frontal assault on our secrets, and they've been very successful at doing it. All you have to do is look at their priority areas. Space is a major priority. The Chinese do not distinguish between civilian and military space. Everything they do for their space program has a military application. And we know, of course, that one of the most serious threats posed by China is their anti-satellite program. That is, they have a number of missiles preparing to shoot down our satellites, basically to blind and cripple the military as well as the civilian satellites if there were ever a crisis or a conflict. And that's really the problem. And again, the government has been slow to react. There's this notion that, oh, we don't want to make waves. We don't want to upset relations with the Chinese. In fact, that's really the case with the Obama administration. They do not want to upset the relationship with China. And yet, at the same time, China is engaged in a massive theft of U.S. secrets as well as private intellectual property from corporations and businesses.
Positioning themselves, certainly, to wage cyber war more generally against us, including perhaps against our infrastructure. Bill, you have two pieces in your Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times this week that are sort of related to this, albeit not necessarily directly focused on China. One is a very interesting and worrying warning of terrorist use of cyber attack against us in what is now being called a black summer of warfare. And then if we can, in addition, cover your interesting insights into our own cyber warfare capabilities, or at least preparations, notably those evidenced in a memo that was made available by Bill Black, a very prominent National Security Agency official. Tell us about both.
Yeah, sure. The one item was U.S. intelligence detected just this week that al-Qaeda terrorists have threatened to attack what they call vital U.S. infrastructure. They've actually called for jihadist hackers around the world to launch what they called Operation Black Summer, something that would be presumably kicked off in the coming months, which would attack our infrastructure. It's not clear how to take this, whether it's take this seriously or not, but you have to be wary that these groups are out there and that they're doing that. We know that the Iranians have been very active. We know that Iran has been helping Hezbollah do hacking, so it has to be a big concern. On the historical documents, very interesting, the NSA, the most secretive electronic spying agency, released, declassified some documents, which revealed back in 1997 how they first received the what they called the computer network attack mission. And this was in a piece in their internal newsletter called Cryptolog, which outlined a piece by, as you mentioned, Bill Black, and where he talks about all of the things that are happening in the cyberspace, and that the future of warfare is cyber warfare. Unfortunately, the Obama administration is taking a passive approach to this. They've announced that they do not plan to use offensive cyber attacks. They're only going to try defense. And the problem there is that the internet is basically a lawless environment, and trying to play defense in protecting your systems in the internet is not going to work. So at some point, they're going to have to realize they're going to have to engage in offensive attacks to deter and to defeat these massive cyber attacks that are coming from all quarters.
Right. And of course, Bill Black has talked about in this memo that you've very helpfully brought to our attention, Bill, cyberology, as he calls it, involving exploitation, protection, and attack as focuses of effort. This was during the Clinton administration, it's interesting to note. Bill Cohen, then the Secretary of Defense, approved this this initiative. And I pray that these capabilities have been at least been honed and will probably need to be brought to bear here shortly. Bill, let me quickly turn to another subject you covered in your Inside the Ring column, namely the concessions that the Obama administration seems to be making on missile defense to placate the Russians. I'd like to get your thoughts on what's happening there, and also just a sanity check, Bill. Is there any evidence at all that the Russians, or for that matter the Chinese, oppose any missile defense except ours? I mean, yes. They're not opposed to having missile defenses themselves, are they?
You're exactly right. This was a very important item. It didn't get any attention in the mainstream press, but the fact is that the new Chinese president, Xi Jinping, traveled to Moscow, met with Vladimir Putin, and the two issued a statement attacking missile defenses. They didn't mention the U.S., but it was clear that they were directly talking about U.S. plans for missile defenses in Europe with NATO. And this is very unusual. You have to ask yourself, why defenses? Defenses are, you know, not offensive. And yet they know that they have offensive missiles and that these systems can counter their offensive missiles. Then we have the situation where Thomas Donilon is set to go to Moscow next month for talks with the Russians to try to restart the missile defense talks. And as you mentioned, Mike Rogers of Alabama, the Alabama Republican and chairman of the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Strategic Forces, has said this appears to be the final step in the Obama administration's cave in to the Russians on missile defense. The Russians want legal restrictions on our missile defenses. For 4 years, they've been resisted, but it now appears that, as we heard the president say last March in Seoul, that he'll have more flexibility after his election, and now they're getting ready to do that.
It seems to be coming to pass. And at the very least, whether he has more flexibility at the negotiating table, he certainly scuppered the phased plan of his missile defenses, yes, in Europe that he himself had advocated, but the Russians opposed, the so-called SM-3 Block 2B. And Bill Gertz, this is worrying stuff, as you've indicated. You're covering it and nobody else is. This is why we really value very, very highly both the work you do at the Washington Times and, of course, the Washington Free Beacon, and your visits with us each week. We'll look forward to the one next week and look forward to talking to the rest of you also next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.